Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 27th of August. Voting this hour, our guest is considered one of the country's preeminent voting experts, and he's written an extremely provocative book, The Voting Wars, from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. He says that all problems with voting go to the issues of partisanship and localism, and we will talk about those issues and voting machines and whether or not there's fraud in voting. There's a lot to consider here. Voter ID bills have been introduced and are in effect in many states in this country. What prompted those. We'll rehash Florida 2000 for those of you who were barely alive at that time. It was a very important time in American history, and we'll look at all that has happened as a result of Florida 2000. The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown is Richard Hasson's book. He is Chancellor Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California Irvine School of Law and is frequently quoted nationally in the press on election laws. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can leave a message for us on our Facebook page, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Rick, thank you so much for being with us. Oh, you're on a different line. I'm sorry. Here we go. Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. We have a lot to talk about with you. Let's start with a general statement that you made. It's no secret that the problems that we have with election are partisanship and localism. What do you mean by both of those?
Well, take the upcoming presidential election, which is we treat it as though it's a single election in November, but actually it's over 10,000 different elections. That is, we don't have a national organization or agency running our election. We do it on the state level, and mostly we do it on the county or sub-county level. And the rules can be different. The people who run the elections are often partisan elected officials or partisan appointed officials. The machines are different. The decisions as to what's going to count as a valid identification will be different in those places that take identification. The decision of which votes will be counted, if they're provisional ballots, is going to be different. And so there's just a wide variety, and that variety leads to both the potential for there to be differences based on people's partisan views and also based on just varying levels of competence and resources. Not everyone's got the same resources to run a gold standard type of election operation.
Why don't we do a national organization of elections and have the same rules applicable everywhere?
Well, the reason we don't have it in this country, I think, is that we have a long history of one scholar has called the hyper-federalization of our elections. We've always done it on the local level. It's very hard to get change. And as I argue in the book, it would be very hard, especially now, to get change because anything that's done with elections now is seen through a partisan lens. But if you look at how other countries do it, most other mature democracies, you look at Australia, Canada, Great Britain, most other mature democracies have for their national elections, so we're talking about to elect the president, the senators, and the members of the House of Representatives, they have a national election run by a national nonpartisan agency. And you walk in anywhere in the country, the machinery is going to look the same, the form of the ballot's going to be the same, and the rules are going to be the same.
Mm-hmm. You start your book with a story that perks our ears up, those of us who live in Wisconsin. You go to the state Supreme Court race, the Prosser Cloppenberg race, and ask the question, what if that had been a presidential race and it was decided ballots were found early in the morning by the Waukesha County clerk, who was a Republican, what kind of national outrage there would have been as a result of that?
Yes. Well, you know, it's actually even worse than you've just described it, because you had a local Republican official who forgot an entire city, the city of Brookfield. She forgot all 15,000 votes on the laptop she was using to store the votes. And then when the Democrat who was supposed to look over her shoulder, a person named, I think her name was Ramona Kitzinger, if I'm remembering the name right, she was asked, Kathy Nicholas do what she was supposed to do? And at first she said, yeah, everything was fine. And then through the Democratic Party, which itself is interesting that this election official is releasing a statement through the Democratic Party, she says something like, I'm 80 years old. I don't know anything about computers. I think what Kathy did was right, but I'm not sure. I'm still very, very confused.
I know.
And so it shows you, you know, and one of the things I talk about consistently in the book is a computer science axiom called Hanlon's Razor, which says, don't attribute to malice that which can be explained by incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats were very quick to jump on Kathy Nicholas as a Republican. She's trying to steal the election. And when, in fact, the Government Accountability Board did an investigation, and what it seemed to show is lack of competence. And this is much more of a problem, on the local level than it is on the state level, but it's on the local level where we actually administer our elections, where the votes get counted, where the basic line decisions get made as to who's going to be able to cast a ballot and whether that ballot's going to count and for whom.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take on this issue of partisanship because it does create problems. It makes you wonder if you have, you know, we don't have to go further past Catherine Harris to think about whether or not she was highly partisan in counting those Florida votes in the year 2000. Why is that? Why is there partisanship when it comes to election? Why would it be? It seems to me as though we would all embrace the idea of if you're an election official, you got to be bipartisan. It's not an appointed position.
Yes. Well, you know, Catherine Harris, who was the Republican elected Secretary of State, was just the tip of the iceberg. Just to remind your listeners, in Florida in 2000, not only was Harris, who was a Republican, she was also, in addition to being the Republican chief election officer of the state, she was also the honorary co-chair of the Bush Election Committee. So that should give you pause.
Mm-hmm.
On election night, there was a call placed from her cell phone to the Governor Bush, and there was a discussion as to whether or not there was an issue with the with her making some kind of plan for what they were going to do. And she said, "No, I was just at Republican headquarters with Al Cardenas, a Republican official, and he used my phone." So the idea that you'd have the chief election officer of the state at a party meeting is a crazy way to be running our election. But it's even worse than that because almost all of the election officials in Florida were partisan. So when you had those votes counted in the various counties, there were contested votes, and you may remember there were these pieces of paper that were used to cast ballots with little chads that came out, the so-called hanging chad. When those were counted, they were counted by Democrats. And we know that even after the election, they sent all the ballots to a place in Chicago, a nonpartisan place, to count the ballots to try and figure out what really happened. A group of news organizations did this. And it turned out that workers who were being paid to be accurate, workers who were Democrats were much more likely to count votes for Gore than workers who were Republicans. So a lot of this is not about a conscious attempt to steal the election or manipulate the vote, but about subconscious bias and also subconscious attitudes about how elections should be run.
Mm-hmm. You printed, and I must say I've never seen this before, the Palm Beach County butterfly ballot for the presidential race. And I must say, if I had looked at it, I may have voted, if I were thinking of voting for Al Gore, I may have mistakenly voted for Pat Buchanan. It's just not clear at all. What a messy ballot that one is, isn't it?
Well, that is another good example of incompetence. The reason we ended up with this ballot, and the way this worked, just so your listeners could picture it, is a cardboard piece of paper would be put inside a machine, and then there would ordinarily be a list of candidates all going along one side of a series of holes, and you would use a little stylus, a little pin, to punch out the hole next to the candidate that you wanted. Well, the local election official, a woman named Teresa Lepore, who was a Democrat, by the way, decided that in Palm Beach County, since Florida allowed so many candidates on the ballot for president, I believe there were 13, that the font size would be too small for the elderly voters of Palm Beach to be able to see. So she said, let's blow up the font, let's make it larger, and we'll put the names on both sides of those holes. And so it created this confusion, and you had No question, thousands of voters who either voted for Buchanan instead of Gore or cast two votes, looking like they were casting one vote for Gore and one for Lieberman against the holes. It was just poor ballot design. And this is another thing that we've seen. Even when Florida moved to electronic voting machines in 2006, they had a race where they had a very close contested congressional race. 18,000 people didn't cast a vote for in the congressional race, but cast in everything else. And that also turned out to be bad ballot design. So a lot of it has to do with lack of uniformity and lack of competence.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about voter ID for a moment, because it's figuring prominently in this presidential race, and it's figuring prominently in the state of Wisconsin, where the state attorney general has asked the Wisconsin Supreme Court to review rulings by other judges, two judges in the state, asking to strike down the state's voter ID law. And Van Hollen wants this to happen before November. Can you talk about this on a national level? How many states have taken up the issue of voter ID? How many more people will have to show voter ID in the presidential election? And why this has become a very large issue in the last couple of years? Do we need it? Why even propose it?
Yeah, we could probably spend the entire show on this.
Yes,
I'll give
we
you
could.
A brief answer. So states have different ways of identifying voters. In California, for example, you use your signature to identify yourself. And, you know, you give your address and then you sign in. And in other states have had different types of identification requirements. Sometimes you have to bring a utility bill or anything with your name and your address on it. What's happened in the last few years is that we've seen the rise of more onerous voter identification requirements, where you have to bring a photographic identification. It has to meet certain requirements. It perhaps has to be issued by a government agency. In Wisconsin, I know that it has to have an expiration date on it, which is what was going to cause the University of Wisconsin system to have to put expiration dates on a bunch of student IDs to make them valid for voting. In every state but Rhode Island, the laws have been passed by Republican legislators, and opposed by Democrats, almost exclusively breaking down on party lines. And even in your neighbor, Minnesota, you have the situation where the Republican legislature passed a voter ID law, the Democratic governor vetoed it, and then the Republican legislature put it on the ballot to be voted on as a constitutional amendment by the people of Minnesota. This has gotten caught up in a huge partisan battle. Almost all of the states where these rules have been put on the books, they've been challenged. In a few states, the courts have struck down the laws as violating the state constitution. That happened, for example, in Missouri. In other states and in federal courts so far, the laws have been upheld against constitutional challenge, most recently in Pennsylvania, where a state judge just upheld the law, said, following what the Supreme Court said about the federal constitution, he applied it to the state constitution and said, generally speaking, having an ID is not a big burden. Most people have it. If there are particular groups of voters who have a special difficulty getting ID, they should bring their own lawsuit and get a constitutional exemption from these laws. And this case is now, the Pennsylvania case is now going to the state Supreme Court. It's going to be argued on September 13th.
Mm-hmm.
The big question about these laws is whether or not they are needed to prevent so-called voter fraud. And this is a big subject in my book. I spent a few chapters talking about it. And it turns out that the kind of fraud that a voter identification law prevents is impersonation fraud. So I go to the polls and I say, I'm Kathleen Dunn. And I pretend I'm someone else. I sign in and vote that ballot. It turns out that this is a very dumb way to steal an election, and it almost never happens. A recent News 21 survey of all 50 states since 2000 found 10 possible cases in the entire country where there were prosecutions the last 12 years, compared to hundreds and hundreds of cases of absentee ballot fraud and election official fraud. And I could talk about those a little bit if you want, but
yes,
those tend to be the way that elections are stolen. I couldn't find for my book a single election where there was, in the last generation, where it was even potentially possible that the election was stolen through impersonation voter fraud. It's just not the way that people engage in chicanery when they do try to do something to change an election result.
Mm-hmm. So why are they being introduced in so many states right now?
I believe the motivation is partisan. That is, the people who tend to lack identification are those who are more likely to be poor, minority, elderly voters who are more likely to vote Democratic. And I don't believe, as some Democrats claim, that these laws are going to disenfranchise millions of voters. We don't know exactly what the effect's going to be, but it seems to be rather small, perhaps 1%, maybe a little bit more. We don't know. But in a very close election, and we could have another very close election this November if the polls are to be believed, that little difference, that little margin can make the difference. Mm-hmm. And further, Republicans use the claims of voter fraud as a way to fundraise and get out the base. Come and vote and don't let them steal your vote. And Democrats use what I consider to be exaggerated claims of voter suppression for the same purpose. Come, get out the vote. Don't let them suppress your vote and prevent you from exercising your rights. And they use it for fundraising as well. So it's become part of the partisan warfare that we generally see. Unfortunately, we're fighting over the very rules for the election.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have lines filled, as you can imagine, at this point in time. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our guest is Rick Hassan. He is professor of law and political science at the University of California, author of The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. He said something intriguing, that if you're going to steal an election, you could do it through absentee votes. We'll talk more about that. And I know many of you have opinions on voter ID, and a lot of the book is premised on the fact that Florida 2000 probably should have told us how we should go about doing elections the right way, but as a result of Florida 2000, everything has become simply more partisan, and things are probably worse when it comes to a flawless, believe-in election system than it was in the year 2000. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This Wednesday, we're going to be announcing the first selection in our back-to-school book club. We're going to have a book club, and one Wednesday each month during this school year, we'll take on an American classic, a book that influenced or reflected our history. So tune in at 10 a.m. on Wednesday to hear the first selection, which we'll talk about on September 26th, and we'll give you a chance to recommend as well the books that you think influenced or reflected our history. It should be fun. You know, the books that you need to read to be a good American. We'll have fun with that, and we'll announce it again Wednesday at 10 o'clock. First caller, Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I guess the first thing I want to say is that I'm a bit indifferent when it comes to the voter ID law. I'm not sure if I'm completely comfortable with it, because the last thing I want is for people that want to vote and don't have an ID that they're not able to vote. And that concerns me a bit as a conservative. I think everybody should, it's their obligation and their duty to vote, and if they want to, they should be able to. My question has to do with how do we fix the system? I was reading a book, Who's Counting, and where they detailed pretty well what happened in Minnesota with the Al Franken election in 08, where Franken eventually won by 312 votes. But afterwards, and after he was sworn in, doing some investigation, found out there were 1,099 felons that voted. So far, they've gotten 177 convictions, not prosecutions, convictions, where they've gotten 177 people that knew they weren't supposed to vote, and they did vote, with hundreds of cases to look at yet. So you're looking at an election that really was stolen. I mean, probably stolen, when you've got 1,099 felons that you know voted in that election. You don't know they all voted for Franken, but there's a good chance that they have, because of the 100. So I'm wondering how you correct this issue so you don't have a situation where, like, Norm Coleman loses an election that he probably did win.
Rick.
Yeah, well, first of all, I would take what's in the Von Spakovsky Fund book, Who's Counting, with a grain of salt. And I'd point you to, if you go to my election law blog and you search for Minnesota, you'll be able to find links to a number of stories which have debunked what's been said by those two authors in that book, as well as the reports of Minnesota Majority, which was the organization which claimed that the election was stolen. And in fact, I think this is part of the problem, which is that there's a lot of very heated partisan rhetoric out there, and it turns out that much of it is untrue or exaggerated. As far as felons voting, one of the problems we saw in Minnesota, and we saw it also in another contested race that gets Republicans very upset, which was the gubernatorial race in 2004 between Rossi and Gregoire in Washington State, was that a number of felons voted because election officials sent them registration materials. These were felons who had completed their sentences. They were still on probation or still under some kind of court control, and they weren't allowed to vote, but they didn't know that. And in fact, you had the U.S. attorney in Washington State say, I didn't prosecute any of these former felons for voting because they were given the registration materials. They didn't know they were breaking the law. Again, Hanlon's razor, incompetence, not malice. This was not a scheme to try and steal the election, but instead incompetence as to who is entitled to vote. Now, on the broader question of what we could do to try to move things forward, I have a number of proposals in the book. I don't expect to see any of them implemented in this hyper-partisan atmosphere. But what I would like to see is first adopting nonpartisan election administration. And your state actually at the state level does better at the Government Accountability Board than is done in other places. What I'd like to see is a national election board or election czar who would be nominated by the president and confirmed by a vote of 75% of the Senate. And anybody that could make it through 75% of today's Senate would have to be someone who would be accepted by everyone as an honest broker. Another model that might work would be to have the Democrats in the Senate choose one election board member, the Republicans choose another, and the two of them choose a third neutral member. There are ways we could try to achieve a level of nonpartisanship. There are lots of things we could do even aside from that, such as how about a uniform federal ballot so that the ballot looks the same everywhere you go, and that would alleviate problems like the butterfly ballot. There are many things we could do. I just don't see the political will. When we do see change, it is change that is happening proposed by one party and opposed by the other.
Right.
Democrats want Election Day registration. Why do you think they want Election Day registration? They want to make it easier for people to vote because they think that those casual voters who are more likely to vote Democratic are going to be able to vote. So it's not just Republicans playing this game. It's both parties trying to pass election rules that will favor their own side's interests.
Mm. Thank you, Scott, for the call. Victor in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. Two questions. One is, will Internet voting resolve this problem? Because there's an argument for it. I have my doubts on it because whoever has control of the database is subject to the same partisan attitudes. Second quick question is, I got an interesting chain email. I'm going to vote for President Obama. I'm not going to make a secret about that. My voting mind is made up. But there's this concern that if you vote for a straight Democratic ticket, your vote may not count toward Obama. And I'm suspecting those who would vote straight Republican ticket, it may cause the same concern for voting for Romney. I'm checking to see, did you hear anything about that?
Yeah, let me start with the Internet voting question. I think Internet voting would be a disaster for this country right now, again, because of issues of competence, not because of issues of partisanship necessarily. And I have a chapter of my book that starts with the University of Michigan fight song, Hail to the Victors. And the reason it starts with that song is because that was the song that was playing through the D.C. Board of Election computers when the D.C. Board of Elections tried to run an experiment to see if they could use Internet voting for their overseas and military voters. They said, come, try and hack our system before we make it live. And these Michigan researchers went in, they were able to hack the system, and not only that, they were in there for 4 days before they were detected. They saw hacks coming from China, coming from Iran.
Goodness.
They were able to change all the votes. They were able to see how people were voting. And finally, they just sent the music through to try and get somebody's attention. Internet voting is not ready for prime time. And as your caller seemed to indicate, lack of trust. In this atmosphere where we have such a lack of trust, the idea that votes would be trusted to a computer where there would be no paper record for anyone to check, where just, even if we were technologically competent to do Internet voting, then we are not politically ready for internet voting. On the question of the straight ticket vote, I have not heard that. But, you know, around election time, there are all kinds of rumors as well as dirty tricks I talk about in the book. You know, sometimes you have emails sent around saying Democrats vote on Wednesday, right, or all kinds of dirty tricks that people try to pull near election time.
Thanks very much for the call. So if you were going to steal an election, you would do so through absentee votes?
Yeah. One of the stories I tell in my book is a 1996 Dodge County commissioner race where you had the two candidates' camps at opposite ends of the county courthouse bidding on absentee ballots. And the reason you have absentee ballot fraud is very simple. It's a way to verify how someone voted. You can collect the absentee ballot, see how it's voted, and then hand it in. Right here in Cudahy, California, a small city in Los Angeles County, we had absentee ballots being returned to City Hall for people voting. They were steamed open by election officials. The ones for incumbents were resealed. The other ones were thrown away. So absentee ballot fraud allows you to do it. Now, I don't want to overstate it. I don't believe that fraud is rampant. I think even absentee ballot fraud is a relatively small problem. It's just much, much, much larger than any problem with impersonation fraud. And this is what tells me that Republicans are not serious about preventing voter fraud when they go around talking about ID laws. They haven't proposed the single best way to lower voter fraud in this country, which would be to eliminate absentee ballots, except for those people who need them, you know, the elderly, those military overseas. We could eliminate most of the little amount of fraud we had in this country by getting rid of absentee ballots, yet we don't do it. And I'd say the reason we don't do it is because Republicans tend to use absentee ballots and they like them.
Well, even Democrats have been proponents of absentee. Vote early. You can do this early.
Oh, sure. Well, absentee balloting has great advantages. The question is whether the cost in potential voter fraud, election fraud, is worth those benefits. Now, I think it is. I would not eliminate absentee balloting. I would go after the fraud more directly, and we do see prosecutions. So you look, every year there are prosecutions for absentee ballot fraud, and you need to have prosecutors vigilant for that. But the point is, there's so much more of that than there is of the kind of impersonation fraud, which is the whole basis for the voter ID. Voter ID doesn't prevent vote buying through absentee ballots. It does nothing to do with that. And that's, you know, if you look again at that News 21 study, hundreds of cases of prosecuted absentee ballot fraud, almost no cases of impersonation fraud.
Hmm. Who won the presidential election in Florida in 2000?
Well, I think, you know, if you could ask people who they intended to vote for, it seems pretty clear that more people intended to vote for Gore than to vote for Bush. But in terms of legally cast votes, we will never know. The margin of victory was greatly exceeded by the margin of error in that case. In fact, that study I talked about after the election, it found that if you did the recount the way that Gore wanted in Florida, which was just count the undervotes in the four counties he had picked, he would have lost. The only way he would have won is if they would have recounted all the ballots in the entire state, undervotes and overvotes, and then he maybe would have won. There were so many things that went wrong in that election that there's no way to say who really won Florida.
And as a result of that election, which was incredibly traumatic for this country, it was unbelievable that we didn't know for all these days who in the world was going to be the president. Surely there must have been a thorough examination of what went wrong, and surely there must have been thorough recommendations of how to make it better.
There were recommendations. There have been commissions. There's been federal legislation. So here's the one piece of good news about the way we run our elections. The machinery is much better. And so we think that, you know, more than a million ballots in each election are now being counted that used to be lost to bad technology. So gone are those punch card machines with the hanging chads. The worst technology has been phased out. So that's the good news. But in terms of the other recommendations, the recommendations which would require political change, they haven't happened. And I'll point out that I think in 2000, there were 33 states with chief election officers who were elected in partisan elections. The only change that's happened since then is that Florida has taken its elected partisan secretary of state and made it an appointed position as someone who serves at the pleasure of the governor, actually made the position more political rather than less political. And in Florida right now, there's a controversy over an attempt to use the Department of Homeland Security database to remove non-citizens from the voting rolls. The appointed Secretary of State named Kurt Browning left office. He resigned, and some people think he resigned because he was uncomfortable. He admitted he was uncomfortable with the purge that the governor wanted, and now there's a new Secretary of State. They're going ahead with this voter purge. There are a number of lawsuits that are brought against it, and we see once again Florida as the epicenter of fighting over election rules.
Bonnie in Oshkosh, hi.
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 My question today, or comment, I guess, is the state of Oregon has had by mail voting for over a decade. They seem to have the highest rate of turnout, least amount of fraud. Washington State has now joined them in vote by mail. And I guess I wonder why there isn't more of that being pushed. You know, everybody gets their ballot from their mailman who knows where people live and who doesn't live there anymore. Why aren't we going more in that direction instead of making it harder? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Yeah, well, first of all, I've seen some recent studies which suggest that although turnout initially went up when Oregon went to all vote-by-mail elections, it then went back down, that there was a novelty effect. And so it actually doesn't increase turnout. It also might skew turnout towards those who are wealthier, who move less, who are the ones who are going to be more likely to receive that absentee ballot and be able to return it. The problem, again, with absentee ballots is that although the incidence of fraud and coercion seem to be quite low in Oregon and Washington, there are other parts of the country, especially in the Southeast, where there have been long history of problems with absentee ballot fraud and vote buying. And so I think taking that solution and making it mandatory would actually increase the potential for there to be problems with vote buying and other voter fraud. What works there may not work somewhere else.
Dick in Sister Bay, hi.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask the professor about black box voting. I don't know if he's familiar with the website and the group that is very concerned about how the electronics in many of these systems that are scannable can be rigged. I know there's a lawsuit that's been going on for a number of years in Tucson, and it's a concern of mine that the corporations that make these machines know how they can be rigged, and the politicians aren't paying attention to that. Does he have a comment?
Yeah, I'm very skeptical of the claims that and let's just be clear what we're talking about. So we're talking about people are voting on a piece of paper, and they're filling it in with a pencil or a pen, kind of like the way you would take the SAT. And then these stacks of paper are scanned through machines. And the claim is that the machines that count those votes are somehow manipulated so that, and usually the way the story goes, it's helping Republicans. I talk about a group in my book that claims that there's a subtle red shift which shifts the votes towards Republicans. These claims have not been proven. And in fact, you have some of the best election law, computer science people looking at this. They have not found any proof of it. And the best thing that we can do to prevent this and make sure that nothing like this happens, because people are voting on paper and those ballots are available, we can always do a check, a random audit, which to make sure that the ballots are accurately being counted. Lots of times there are potential problems. And in fact, we just had a situation in Florida, once again in Florida, where the machines were misprogrammed and they actually miscounted the votes. But because of an audit, we were able to catch the problem and the election results were certified correctly. So we do need to do audits and as long as we have paper, I think, and people who are vigilant to make sure that nothing like this is happening, I think the concerns are pretty much overblown.
What's the best machine, the most accurate machine, and what's the best way to vote if you're using a machine?
Well, this, as with, I think, just about every question you've asked me, there are arguments on both sides of these things. There seems to be a convergence toward the use of these precinct-level optical scans. That is where you fill in on the piece of paper, you fill in the bubble, and then they're scanned in the polling place to make sure that the votes were accurately counted, that you didn't skip any votes unless you intended to skip the votes. A lot of people like the ATM-style machines. Because they're very easy to use. You touch the screen and it's easy to go through. But other people distrust them because the votes are not leading to the creation of a piece of paper that could be recounted. And also, because these machines have to be installed in all polling places across the country, you end up with all kinds of problems with poll workers who don't know how to use the machines. They don't plug them in. If there's a printer, the printer doesn't work. And so paper and pen or paper and pencil seems to be one of the tried and true ways to cast a vote. And it's the way that I think seems to make the most sense right now for us.
Paper and pencil.
Or paper and pen, yes.
Mm-hmm. Bob in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
A couple of comments. I once helped tried to help an older gentleman to get a picture ID. He had his Army discharge papers. That's the only thing he had. We went to the county clerk to get a birth certificate, and she said she wasn't supposed to give him one without a picture ID. And, of course, he couldn't get a picture ID without the birth certificate. She did give him his birth certificate after asking him several questions, and he was able to get the ID, but she said she wasn't supposed to do that. The other comment is my father worked as an election official in Ohio, and I went over the manual with him. He wasn't real computer savvy and in his 80s at the time. The machine they were using was a computer-based machine. It was supposed to create a tape, much like a cash register tape, that was inside the machine that no one could see until the election was over. It would be taken out. And this was supposed to be the paper trail for the votes, of course, which could have been easily manipulated. The other thing was that the Republicans came and passed out absentee ballots in the religious retirement community where he was living, and they were sent back to a Republican election official, not to the party, but to an election official appointed by the party, basically, because it was a Republican-controlled county. Have any comments on this?
Well, again, you know, we're back down to the issue of, on your second point, on the issue of localism. And on many states require that absentee ballots be returned directly to the county board or whoever is going to be counting the votes. We hear stories of nursing homes where you have the workers who are voting the ballots for the people who are in the nursing home. Either they're filling them out, asking them how to vote, or they're not. Whenever you have ballots out of the control of public view and election officials, you have the potential for these problems. In terms of the inability to get a birth certificate, this was one of the bases for the lawsuit now in Pennsylvania to try to get its law struck down. There are people who have trouble getting birth certificates who don't have the documents. It's hard as it is to believe, since most of us have numerous forms of ID, and it's very hard to negotiate the world without such an ID. There are people who lack the ID, or they have an ID that works just fine for them for what they need to do, but it's not good enough for purposes of voting. And so what the judge has suggested there is that, well, they may be entitled to an exemption. The problem is that the people who are who lack the ID may be the ones who are the most difficult to reach in society, the ones who are going to be the hardest to get them into court to try and get them this exemption in time. And it also turns out that a number of those people are not going to be voting anyway. And so it's not clear that even if a number of these people end up losing the right to vote, that they were actually going to exercise it, which is one of the reasons we have a hard time knowing exactly how much these voter ID laws are actually going to impact voter turnout.
Hmm. Well, it's also the principle of the thing, though, isn't it, that you have to get a birth certificate to get this ID. Birth certificates cost money. It's hard if you are one of these people, and who are we to know whether they're going to vote or not, who may live in a remote area, who don't have a car, obviously, because they don't have a driver's license and have no way to get to the place where you get your birth certificate, and then you have to pay for it. So there is some validity, or maybe you would say there isn't, to it's a form of a poll tax.
Well, I don't know that it counts as a poll tax, but I do think that it imposes serious burdens on some voters. And what the judge said is that those voters should get the exemption. And I guess my response to that is that would make sense if we had a big problem that we were trying to solve. But impersonation fraud is not a big problem. So why are we making it so difficult for people to vote when it's a relatively small problem? I should point out that I don't oppose a national voter ID. What I'd like to see is to take the job of registering voters out of the hands of private individuals, make the government responsible for it, make the government pay for whatever underlying documents would be needed so we get an accurate registry. I'd actually allow people to give a thumbprint if they want to, which they could then use instead of the ID card to verify their identity at the polling place. You have a national ID card. You'd have government registration. As soon as someone graduated high school or dropped out of high school, they'd be registered. When you fill out a change of address form at the post office, your voter registration went with you, so you wouldn't have to re-register. This, I think, would be a sensible way for us to run our registration and election system. But it's a proposal that has managed to unite Democrats and Republicans, and it's united them against the proposal for different reasons.
Really? What are those reasons?
Well, Republicans don't like federalizing anything. They don't want a big government bureaucracy running our elections. They worry that nonpartisan means Democrat. You have Democrats that don't like the ID. They think it's still going to be too hard for people to vote. The ID issue gets caught up in privacy and immigration questions. And so no matter what you propose, there's going to be somebody who doesn't like it who's going to lose on the status quo. And I should point out, there's a lobby for state and local election officials who don't like federal oversight. In 2002, Congress created an organization called the United States Election Assistance Commission, which had the job of handing out money to change voting machines and providing advice and best practices. No oversight responsibilities at all, aside from these voting machines. And the National Association of Secretaries of State has been calling for it to be disbanded. They see it as an infringement on their turf. And right now we're going into the 2012 election. The United States Election Assistance Commission has four commissioners. All four commission seats are vacant. All four seats. There's not a single member of the United States Election Assistance Commission going forward. It's a travesty.
There's not a single member. That's unbelievable.
Go to www.eac.gov. Click on commissioners. You'll see vacant, 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 vacant.
EAC.gov. Okay. Richard Hassan is our guest this hour. His book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. He's Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Deborah in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I just have two comments that have puzzled me since all this brouhaha came up. And one was, if there's a concern that someone isn't who they are at the place at the voting booth, people could put a thumbprint, and they can always be traced back if there's a question. And those can be set aside if the margin of defeat or victory falls within something that could be resolved by the number of votes set aside that were questionable. Count them up and verify with the thumbprint. My other comment is, the whole ID thing, anyone who's run a bar will tell you IDs are very easily faked. So how are they going to get around that? And that's it.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Well, first, on the question of thumbprints, someone would have to be, you'd have to have the voter's actual thumbprint first in order to be able to verify that the person is who they say they are. And then if you're going to try and catch the person who's cast the impersonation vote, they'd have to be in some kind of database with their thumbprint. So that's not clear that it would happen that way. And yes, it's true that you could have fake IDs. We've not seen a problem in those states that have voter ID laws that people are trying to use fake IDs to vote. People use fake IDs to drink at bars, but I don't, again, it's because it's such a dumb way to steal the election. You know, if I want to steal the election, and I'm going to need to find enough people to send into polling places, and I'm going to have them claim to be, I'm going to have to do a lot of investigation to figure out who's not going to vote that day, and do this in a large enough numbers that's actually going to affect the outcome of the election. It's just not a way that people steal elections. If you really want to do it, if you have those absentee ballots in your hand, that's the way you can do it. And again, I want to emphasize, this is not the absentee ballot problem is not a major problem. It's just a contrast with, here are the kind of cases that can actually be found. Well, we've proven fraud where people have been prosecuted. Here are cases where it's extremely rare. The rare prosecution has never been tied to any kind of scheme to try and influence the outcome of an election.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what cases the U.S. Supreme Court may take up in the future when it comes to voting in this country.
Well, the Supreme Court in 2008 upheld the Indiana voter identification law, which was challenged on U.S. constitutional grounds, on grounds that have violated the Equal Protection Clause. And the court said that, generally speaking, these laws are constitutional because most people have ID and it's not a big burden. But for those who have a special problem, a big burden, they can bring a separate as-applied lawsuit to try and get the law exempt as to them. That's the last time that the court has weighed in on the question of voter identification. I don't see any cases on the horizon where they're going to weigh in again, although it is possible that the voter ID issue is going to get caught up at the Supreme Court in a case involving the Voting Rights Act. So just to back up for a second, there are parts of the country, because of a history of discrimination and race on voting, where the state needs to get permission to make any changes to its voting rules before they can be put into effect. Texas and South Carolina both passed voter identification laws, and the U.S. Department of Justice has challenged those laws as violating the Voting Rights Act because they say members of protected minority groups are going to have a harder time getting ID than members of the majority white community. Though the Texas case was argued and is waiting decision from the three-judge court, we're expecting a decision could come this week because there's supposed to be a decision by August 31st on whether or not these IDs can be used. The South Carolina case went to trial this morning. We don't know if that'll make it in time. But it's possible that if the three-judge court blocks the Texas voter ID from going to effect on voting rights grounds, that Texas could file an emergency appeal with the Supreme Court to try and use their ID before the election. One of the arguments that Texas and other places are making is that this law since 1965 that requires permission or preclearance is now unconstitutional as an unconstitutional exercise of Congress's power. And so this is a huge issue, the voting rights issue. If it doesn't come up in the voter ID context, it's going to come up probably in another case that's out of Alabama that the court could consider early next year and rule by next June.
Thanks, Deborah. Tom in Burlington, hi.
So in other words, what you're saying is there are exemptions to this. Even if it does go through, there will be an exemption. But that's not the real question I asked you about. I called on. Here in Wisconsin, I vote by absentee, and they send me an envelope. It's a self-stamped envelope. But when that envelope goes to the post office, for some reason, it isn't stamped. The time and date isn't stamped on it. And my last time I tried, they said, "Well, your ballot came back late," and so this is another way with the absentee ballot thing can be fudged or gone around. Anyway, it's a staggering. There's 100 million people don't vote in our country.
Well, a couple of things. First, on the exemptions, what the courts have said is that those who face special burdens can file a lawsuit to get an exemption. It's not as though the law as written contains the exemption, and getting a court to grant such an exemption, I think, would probably be a pretty big undertaking. So we haven't seen a lot of cases like that, in part because I think there aren't a lot of people who don't have the ballots but who want to be able to vote in time for the election. In terms of the post office, you hear different stories about how well the post office handles the mail. And whether or not they get the absentee ballots in time. And this is one of the reasons that some people don't want to use an absentee ballot. So in Indiana, if you're over 65, you don't have to show ID. You can get an absentee ballot. But some people don't want to vote with the absentee ballot because they're worried it's not going to be make it in time. And also, there are questions as to whether or not that ballot's going to be counted. Again, those ballots are going to be opened up. There are going to be decisions made by local officials, sometimes partisan officials, and people have less trust in that than going in and casting their ballot on election day.
That was another problem in Florida, wasn't it? Didn't you write about, was it military vote or overseas vote, where people had actually voted after the election day?
Yeah, so there was one story that a couple of ballots faxed from Maryland to an election office in Florida, and those were counted as valid overseas ballots. It looked like a number of ballots came in that were voted after Election Day. It was just a real mess, and hopefully we've done a little bit to improve the military absentee ballot situations. We won't have those kinds of situations going forward.
What is the next election meltdown you worry about?
Well, you know, we don't know when it's going to happen. We do know that we have close elections, but for it to happen on the presidential level, you'd have to have a very, very close election in a state that matters for the Electoral College. So fortunately, that's unlikely to happen in any particular election, but I think it will happen eventually. And I worry in the book that because of social media, we've become even more partisan. And watching what happened during the first set of the Wisconsin state recalls, watching Twitter in real time, you could just see the anger and partisan recriminations on both sides. things can deteriorate very quickly, even to threats of violence. And so I worry that the next election meltdown will pour onto the streets.
And it could be in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, let's hope not. Let's hope it's your state has been through quite a set of travails recently when it comes to elections.
Thank you so much for being with us, Richard.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guest is our Richard Hassan. His book is The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Richard is professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. He was the founding co-editor of the peer-reviewed Election Law Journal and is quoted all over the country on election laws. Mitt Romney is the nation's first Mormon nominee for president, and tomorrow during this time period, writer Jane Barnes will talk about why she fell in love with Joseph Smith, the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She will be with us during this time period tomorrow. And we would like to thank special help from Rob Ferret producing this hour of the program. Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning are producers. And thanks to you, everybody, for your calls. Great conversations ahead.